Okay, welcome back. We're going to start the second half of class. And I've started my recording back up, so you're now on tape. And we are ready. We're halfway through. Okay, halfway through. Probably more than halfway through. I'd say we did the big half at the beginning. So we're ready for section C. This is where we specifically talk about the law of large numbers. I have alluded to this a couple of times earlier in my lecture, but now we're going to get to the part where the book actually talks about this, and they open with this on page 437. All right, so if we talk about the probability of something happening, okay, we're talking about after repeated trials, okay? And if we really want to get exactly that number in our theoretical investigation, then we have to have a lot of trials. We need a large number in our experiment before our probabilities are really going to come close to the probability that's found through theoretical means. So the larger the number of trials, the closer you're going to get to your theoretical probability. If you only do it once or twice, it's not going to work. So here we are, okay, and it says we're rolling dice. Shows the result of a computer simulation rolling a die, okay? And we're looking for how this probability works out. The expected probability is right here, 1/6, okay? 1/6 of getting that same thing to happen every time. They're looking at the proportion of ones, okay? So you see that at first you're way below, and then for a while maybe you go above, but as we're throwing it more and more and more times, so when we get out here at around 4,000 to 5,000 times, we are finally at the point where our experiment is running exactly like we would expect it, that we are getting a 1 about 1/6 of the time. If you have a smaller field of events, okay, a small, then you could miss by quite a bit if your number is really small. You know, I told you, I made the statement 100 was really a small number of throws as compared to, you know, 5,000. So you have to do it a large number of times before your experiment is going to match up with your theory. Think about a roulette wheel, 38 numbers, 18 are black, 18 are red, and two of them, the zero and the zero, double zero, are green. Assume that all possible outcomes of the 38 numbers have equal probability. When I spin the wheel, it's equally likely it lands on any one of those. So what is the probability of getting a red number on any one spin? Well, I've got 18 red numbers, so I've got 18 successes out of 38 possibilities. So I see that that probability is 18 over 38, or about 47%. If patrons in a casino spin the wheel 100,000 times, okay? Casinos are busy, lots of people in them, all right? How many times should you expect a red number? Well, the law of large numbers would say 100,000 is a pretty large number. We should be somewhere close to that 0.474. So 47.4% of 100,000 is, I would expect to land on red around 47,400 times, okay? It's just a percentage calculation. If I'm only going to spin the wheel twice, you know, who knows? I could get anything. It's not a big enough number to make any real prediction. Consider two events, each with its own value and probability, okay? So if we want to talk about the expected value of this, we'd have to say the value of the first event times the probability of that event, plus the value of the second event times the probability of that event. And I can extend this out to as many events as I have. This is where we start talking about how does the automobile or house, whatever, how does the insurance industry decide what to charge you?
Okay, I mean, you ever wonder, do they just draw those numbers out of a hat?
I sometimes think they just say, let's pick a bigger number than last year. But, you know, whatever, there is a strategy to this. And actually, if you have a job in this field where you're helping the insurance industry calculate where their rates need to be for various people with various driving records or various health considerations. You're called an actuary, and it's rather challenging mathematics, and you make very good money to sit in a room all by yourself and crack numbers on your computer day after day after day. I would go crazy. But it is. I had a colleague that left math education to become an actuary, and he loved it. He decided the kids were making him insane, and a little cubicle with just him and his computer was starting to look real good to him. So anyway, an actuary helps insurance companies do this. Suppose an automobile insurance company sells an insurance policy with an annual premium of $200. So that's what I'm going to pay for my policy. Based on data from past claims, the company has calculated the following probability, okay? So they take a look. How have things gone for the last 10 years or whatever with our policy holders? And what they do, looking at their data, this is relative probability, they consider that 1 in 50 policyholders will file a claim of $2,000, okay? 1 in 20 policyholders will file a claim of $1,000, and 1 in 10 will file a claim of $500. So these are their expected outcomes based upon the clientele that they have in the recent years. This is what they would expect to have happen. Let's move on from there. Assuming that a policyholder could file any of these claims, what is the expected value to the company
for each policy sold? Okay,
so they're now going to go out and they're going to get a new client. Okay, brand new, never bought insurance from them before. All right, this person is going to give them $200 and buy a policy. Okay, so initially they make $200 off of these people because they pay for their policy. But there is the likelihood that they're going to have to pay out on this policy. And since this person has no personal history with them, they're going to assume that this person will act like all of their other policyholders. If you start to stand out in the crowd, this is when the insurance company starts to either treat you differently, as in charge you more for your policy, or just simply inform you they will no longer insure you. Okay? We have friends whose 21-year-old son, got kicked off the family insurance by the insurance company. Because he wrecked so many vehicles. I mean, it was just crazy. I kept wondering why they left him on there. But finally, the insurance company said, you can do whatever you want with your kid, but not with our company. We're not insuring anymore. He just kept wrecking vehicles. But they're going to treat you initially as though you're going to behave like all their other policy owners. So they're expecting about this. So how do we figure expected value? Well, here we go. The $200 premium is positive income. That goes directly to the company, so that's a plus 200. And it has a probability of 1 because I have to pay my premium or I am not a policyholder. Okay, so that's a guaranteed event. I'm buying this insurance, I am paying the $200. So 200 times the probability of 1. Then we start talking about the possibility of the claims. Every claim is a negative for the insurance company. Now they have to pay out. It's an expense as far as they're concerned. So here's the $200 I gave them times 1. Then they might have to pay out $2,000. So we use the negative to show they're paying it out. And there's a 1 out of 50 chance that that's going to happen. Or they might have to pay $1,000. And there's a 1 out of 20 chance of that happening. Or they might have to pay out $500, and there's a 1 in 10 chance that that's going to happen. If you take your calculator and you put all those numbers in and do that math, you should come up with $60. So what the insurance company knows is that on average, for every $200 premium that they sell to people, they can expect to make about $60. Okay, because not everybody's going to drive perfectly. If everyone drove perfectly, they'd make $200 on each one, but they don't. All right, and so they can calculate based upon their data, and they know about what to expect is going to happen. All right, so this suggests that if a company sells many policies, again, law of large numbers, they have to have a lot of clients, they have to have sold a lot of policies for this number to really hold true. then we would say on average they're going to make about $60 per policy. Some people, they're going to lose money big, okay? Some people, they're going to make money big. It just depends on how things go for that particular family. Okay, then there's something called the gambler's fallacy. I believe the gambler's fallacy was referenced in chapter one, so again, week one of this class, when we were talking about all these different fallacies. I think it was off in the margin, or it was just a little aside. It was not a real big thing mentioned. But we were talking about all those different fallacies, things that people tend to believe that are not true, okay? And the gambler's fallacy is definitely one of them. And that is, if things have not been going well for me, then I'm due for things to turn around. So if I just hang in the game, okay, I'm going to start winning. So here's their example of why this is a fallacy, why it is not true. Suppose you're playing the coin toss game, in which you win $1 for heads and you lose $1 for tails.
All right.
After 100 tosses, you are $10 in the hole because you have flipped 45 heads and 55 tails. Okay? So I've won $45, but I've lost $55, so I'm 10 less than when I entered the game. Okay? Overall, I've lost $10. The empirical probability of this is 0.45 heads. Okay? So you go, well, I've been losing. If I just say and stay in the game, things are going to turn around for me. It's going to get better. So you stay in and you actually toss this coin 1,000 times with this same thing going on. You get 480 heads and 520 tails.
Okay.
Does this result agree with the law of large numbers? Well, the law of large numbers would say it's 50-50, 500, 500. Okay, we are not that far off of that. 48% to 52% is pretty close to 50-50. So I would say it agrees with the law of large numbers, given that 1,000 is not huge. Remember that table showed us out at about 5,000. It was a perfect match. Have you gained back any of your losses? This is the bigger question, okay? So let's look at that. Proportion of heads in your 100 tosses was 45%. After you went to 1,000 tosses, you got up to 48%. So as we have more tosses, we are getting closer to the theoretical 50%, okay? I was at 100 tosses, I was 45%. By 1,000 tosses, I'm at 48%. If I'm stupid enough to keep doing this, by about 5,000 tosses, I'm going to be probably at about 50%, okay? So, yes, it's behaving the way we would expect it to. This agrees with the law of large numbers, because we're getting closer to 50%. However, let's talk about the money exchanged, all right? I've won $480, but I've lost $520, so my net loss is now $40. Whereas before I had lost $10, now I have lost $40. Wasn't it brilliant that I stayed in the game? Okay. So although I did in fact start tossing more heads, I did not in fact regain my losses, no less start actually winning money. Now, is it possible to win money? Sure. Okay. If the table had been reversed, I would be ahead. But the likelihood is not going to be any better just because you were losing for a while. And now you're winning more. So four streaks. For tossing a coin six times, the outcomes, heads, tails, tails, heads, tails, heads, and heads, 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 are equally likely.
Okay.
I might get one, I might get another. All right. So just because you have a streak. Now, if you toss it 6,000 times, you're going to likely end up with about a 50-50 average. Okay, but you have to do it a lot of times before you get there. Each event is independent. The house edge, the expected value to the casino for a particular bet. You can bet that the casino has already figured out the odds so that they are likely to win money and not lose. Okay, casinos are a business, all right? Not a goodwill institution, so you're not likely to beat them very often. Will you sometimes? Sure. Not often. Assessing risk. It's interesting the things that we are afraid to do because they're too dangerous. And the things that we do every day and don't think anything about it that are actually more dangerous. So one such example is driving around in your car versus, say, getting on an airplane and flying somewhere. It turns out that airplane crashes get a lot more publicity than car accidents. Car accidents happen every day in Dallas, multiple ones.
So they don't put that on
the news every time it happens. In fact, they don't usually put it on the news unless somebody dies. And they might not put it on the news unless somebody died and there was something really unusual in the circumstances, because it happens so often because so many people are on the road. But if somebody crashes a plane out at DFW, I'm telling you, that's all over the news for several days. So what we hear about, we tend to think is more dangerous. So people tend to be more afraid of flying than driving. But actually, if you look at it, it's much safer to be on the plane than in your car in Dallas, driving around. So here's driving risks, okay? This is some data. This is data occurs over a long period of time between 1970 and 2011, all right? So this is data over a long period of time, and we are looking at the number of deaths that occur, all right, in driving. This is highway driving. And so the question then is driving getting safer? Well, first of all, we want to notice that people are driving more, okay? This blue line, nothing to do with the orange boxes. This blue line is the line that represents vehicle miles driven. Okay, this is over here. How many miles do people tend to drive? Let me see if I can move the pictures for a minute. There, now we can actually read it. Vehicle miles in trillions, okay? So we see that as compared to 1970, where people on average were driving less than, what's that number? 1.2 trillion in the U.S. Now, not even now, several years ago, in 2011, people were almost hitting 3 trillion.
Okay.
So the amount of driving is going up. People are driving more and more. On the other hand, the orange bars, they are based on this axis over here, and this is the number of deaths that occur on the highway due to driving. And we see that in the 70s, this was over 50,000 a year. And as you come around, right, this clump right here is the late 70s, early 80s. It kind of spikes up. It's still over 50,000, but after that, it comes down. All right, and it comes down. We're very low in 1992, goes up just a little bit, but it's mostly stayed right there around the 40,000 mark. And then in about 2008, it drops down, and in 2009, it drops further, and it continues to drop down. Okay, so we talked about reading tables last week. We talked about all these different tables and what kind of information can you get from a table, and are you getting as much out of the table as the person who created it hoped you would. I think a lot of people would just ignore this blue line and never even think about the vehicle miles. It's so subtle compared to all that orange that just kind of stands up and screams at you, all right? But they're actually giving us two pieces of information. So we see driving is increasing, but the death rate is going down. So can we make the statement that driving is getting safer?
Yes.
Yeah, we really can. Any thoughts about why driving is getting safer?
Seatbelts.
Seatbelts are a big one. Yeah. Let's see. I started driving in 1974 because I lived in Western Kansas and you could drive at 14. It was a wonderful thing.
Wow.
funny how I have not let any of my 14-year-olds who are living in Dallas start driving. That would be a nightmare. But anyway, there were more cows than people where I grew up, so driving was not nearly as scary as it is here. But we were driving 70 miles an hour out on the highway or higher, and nobody was ever wearing a seatbelt. I do not ever remember wearing a seatbelt. Growing up, okay, not at any age.
Not in anybody's car.
It wasn't just that I had crazy, stupid parents. You know, I drove in other people's cars. Nobody said put your seatbelt on. We all merrily went down the road. Everybody was loose, climbing over the seats. We probably just don't even want to think about everything that was going on. And then they knocked the speed limit down for a while, and that helped a little bit. So you just go down a little bit right here. Right after I started driving, they took the speed limit from 70 down to 55. I lived out where you could drive for an hour and only meet one car. I can't tell you how boring 55 miles an hour was. It wasn't really enforced very well as a result. But for a while, that took the death rate down a little bit, but it kind of started creeping back up. It helped some. Eventually, they reinstituted, you know, higher speed limits, Texas being a leader in that one. But in the meantime, everybody starts wearing their seatbelts because there's seatbelt laws.
They made it a law because
people wouldn't start doing it until it was. And what they did was they tied your highway money to it. In a lot of places, states were resistant. They didn't want to pass seatbelt laws. And the federal government said, fine, you can have any laws you want about seatbelts, but you won't get any highway money for us unless you start enforcing the seatbelt law. And so then they started enforcing seatbelt laws, and people actually started wearing their seatbelts. And lo and behold, that thing that they did not want to do saved a lot of lives. Okay, saved a lot of lives. So that's one big thing. Any other contributing factors that you think of?
Other safety features like anti-lock brakes and airbags.
Yeah, and so much brighter headlights. So much brighter headlights. Okay, halogen lights and other kinds of, you know, you can see much further down the road. So nighttime driving is much safer than it used to be. So all of those things have contributed to why driving is getting safer. So risk in travel, all right? If you really look at the numbers, it might be different than you think. In 1970, there were 52,100 deaths. Here's 1970. They're saying that's 52,100. Okay. Out of 1.1 times 10 to the 12th miles driven. So here's our average number of deaths per mile. Almost, you know, when we look at 20,000, 2011, we're down to 32,000 deaths, and our mileage is up to 2.9. So our deaths per mile is now 1.1 times 10 to the negative 8.
All right.
Is 10 always a trillion?
Excuse me?
Is the 10 always the trillion?
Yeah, if you've got 10 to the 12th, that's a trillion.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't know if I didn't start writing it and having to think about it. I can count it, but I would need to look at it. All right, so we conclude that over that time period, the death rate went from 4.7 to 1.1, or a decrease of almost 75%, which I think is even a bigger decrease than this picture suggests. You know, that doesn't really say 75% change to me. Because again, I'm just looking at the orange, but not thinking so much about the fact that at the same time that the death rate's going down, the mileage is going up. And so deaths per mile driven is substantially less, 75% less, for the reasons we talked about. Okay, vital statistics. You also see statistics about leading causes of death in the United States for various reasons. The risk per person, okay? So most people, I think, in the U.S. could tell you heart disease is the number one killer. Makes a lot of commercials on TV, for one thing, okay? And so here you see this table, and you see that heart disease does, in fact, lead cancer. They're fairly close together, but it leads cancer, okay? And there's a big drop-off after that. The next most likely thing is chronic respiratory diseases, emphysema, things like that. Then we see strokes, which arguably are kind of connected to heart disease, but they count them separately. Then we see accidents. Then we see Alzheimer's, diabetes. Okay, and it goes from there. So if we want to calculate, again, the death per person rate, looking at these statistics, it's how many deaths do we have, all right? So for accidents, it was 122,800. per how many people do we have? Remember, this sounds bad, but success over possibilities. So the accidents that resulted in death, there were 122,800 out of how many people we had, which is 315 million. All right. So that number in the bottom is our possibilities. That's how many people there were that year that could have passed away in an accident. Okay. And this is how many actually did. You do that division and you get this for your death rate per person. Often these are stated as out of 100,000 people. Instead of death per person, they say how many deaths were there per 100,000 people. Because 0.00039 is a number that we don't have much intuition about. So the government tries to state statistics in a way that they think will have meaning for people. And the thought is, and I would agree, 39 deaths out of every 100,000 people on the road is something I can kind of wrap my head around. I understand what it means. Versus 0.00039 being the death rate per person, I'm kind of like, okay, that's nice. Looks like a small number. I'm probably okay. So all you do is take this number times 100,000 to get this out of 100,000 people. So if you have a quiz question that gives you this table of data and asks you to calculate something out of deaths per 100,000 people, first just calculate your number of people, the outcome you're looking for, okay, divided by how many possibilities there were, and then multiply it times the 100,000, okay? That's all they're doing to get from here to here. All right, so here's suicide, same sort of thing. When I multiply that times 100,000, I find out there's 12 out of every 100,000, okay? Now, if we don't talk about all people and we just talk about a small group of people, like, say, teenagers, that number's a lot higher, okay? But in other age populations, not so much. Life expectancy is the number of additional years a person of a given age is likely to live. Okay, now this is another one that we don't always understand this the same way it's intended. So it's given how old I am today, what is my life expectancy? How much older do I expect to turn? Okay, and so we see in 1900, life expectancy was less than 50 years for both men and women. Women have always outlived men. Okay, always outlived men. How's your history? What's going on right there?
War.
War. World War I, yeah. A lot of deaths right there, okay? But always we see women ahead of men. If you go to a nursing home, there's more women there than men, okay? The men are already gone, the women are still hanging around. I believe on insurance, life insurance policies, ladies get a plus five over men, okay? Because it has just always been that way for whatever reason, okay? Find the life expectancies of a 20-year-old person and a 60-year-old person, okay? So if I am 20, then it says I should expect to live about 60 more years. On the other hand, if I am 60, it says I should expect to live 25 more years, okay? So if I am 60, they're saying I'll probably live to 85. If I am 20, they are saying you'll probably live to be 80.
How come things
look worse for the 20-year-old? No thoughts? People likely to die young. At 20, they haven't died yet. At 65, they're already gone, okay? So if I've made it to 60, then I've already missed those things that would have typically taken me at a younger age, all right? And so I'm more likely to live a little bit longer, okay? But at 20, you live about 60 years. Okay, they said 23, I said 25, sorry. So one gets to live to be 80, the other one gets to expected to live to 83. So a lot of people are like, wait, I think that's wrong. Young people are going to live longer. We all know that. But it's based on current data, okay? Now, if things keep getting better, that 20-year-old may live quite a lot longer. Somebody cures cancer, okay, when that 20-year-old turns 35, then suddenly their life expectancy is going to shoot up substantially higher, okay? So life is not always staying the same, but we're assuming, when they make that kind of assumption, when they make that kind of prediction, it's based upon what is going on now, okay? All right, using figure 7-12, determine how much life expectancy rose during the 20th century. I got to go back. What's 7-12? No, okay, let's see if it moves forward and shows it to me. Using figure 7-12, determine how much life expectancy rose during the 20th century. Suppose that life expectancies rise by the same amount during this century. What will life expectancies at birth be for children that are born in the year 2100? What are the implications for your own life expectancy? So we've got to go back and see this table. Sorry. Very inconvenient. Here we go. Here's our life expectancy table, okay? So between 1900 and the year 2000, we see that life expectancies go from below 50 to, for women, up to 80,
and for
men, up to 75.
Okay,
that much gain in 100 years. So that's a gain of 80 minus 48.
Okay, 32
for the women, and 75 minus 45, 30 for the men, roughly, just looking at it. Okay, estimating those numbers. So if we're going to gain that much again, then by the year 2100, men should live 35 years longer than this predicted 75. They're living over 100 years. Agreed? And the prediction would be the same for women. Now, what are we assuming there? We're assuming that the same kind of growth we saw over this century is going to continue over the next century. Now, how good or bad do we think that assumption is? Well, different people would give you different opinions. There were a lot of substantial things that occurred during this century that led to this growth. We discovered antibiotics. That was huge. Okay? Just huge. They made such a big difference in treating so many things. Just as one example, okay? So, do we think that we will discover another medication that will be equally helpful? Drug companies hope so, all right? They certainly come out with new ones all the time. But those are the kinds of questions you want to ask yourself, okay? So let's go back. Here's the question they proposed. What will life expectancies at birth be for children born in the year 2100? What are the own implications for our own life expectancy? Okay, so we see the gains that we talked about, okay? 48 years for women, and they said 46 years for men. I must have done poor mental math. That happens. Okay, so we see these changes. If that same increase occurs in the century, in the next century, then women would live 32 years longer than their current 80 years, so they'd live to approximately 112. Men would be hitting around 102. Now, I have to insert at this point so you can know what kind of family I come from. My great-grandmother is still alive at 105. And my other grandmother passed away at 98. I had great-grandfathers that passed away at 98 and 96. There's a really good chance I'm going to be around for a long time, just looking at my family. You know, these are people that were two generations older than me and living up to or nearly 100. My grandmother, who's 105, one of her sisters just passed away at 102. And she lived at home by herself until her last 6 months of life. It was incredible. So some of this has to do with your family genetics, too. I like to tell my students this at school. I say, you know, you think I'm going to retire, but you have no idea. I can't afford to retire yet. I may have 50 years left, okay? I got to bring in some income for longer. And they're just cracking up. there's no way. But yeah, you should meet my family. Okay, so here we go. If life expectancy increases as much in the 21st century as it did in the 20th century, we've got these huge numbers, 112 and 102, okay? Although this example deals with life expectancy at birth, life expectancies for all ages, not just at birth, would tend to rise together, okay? We noticed that although the 20-year-old was only expected to hit 80, whereas the 60-year-old was expected to hit 83, that's really a relatively small difference compared to, you know, the overall total. It's about the same. So an average newborn, okay, would expect to live 100 to 110. Newborn born in the year 2100. So that's assuming that things consider, you know, go the same way that they've been going. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. It's kind of a big assumption, but that is what they are assuming. Okay, let's look at some questions, possible questions from these two sections, and we'll call it a night. I took some things from both chapter 7C and D. Okay, so we'll go back into C. And the first one that I wrote down, I'm pretty sure these are in your quiz. And so I wanted to for sure do an example of this. And that is number 24. Okay, number 24 on page... Let me find the page number, 444. I'm going to erase that. I'm going to try my board again.
We're on page 444.
Okay. And I want to look at question 24. So first, let's read through it, then we'll try to break it down. Suppose you roll a die with the following rules. You will win $1 if the die comes up with an even number, and you will lose $1 if it comes up with an odd number. Okay? Well, even numbers would be 2, 4, and 6. Odd numbers would be 1, 3, and 5. So let's think about this for a minute.
If I roll a 2, 4, or 6, I have one outcome. And if I roll a 1, 3, or 5, I have the other.
And I don't remember which was the winner or the loser, so I've got to walk back over here and look at my book. It's a winner if it's even. Okay, so I have a plus $1
for any one of those even rolls and a minus
$1 for any one of those odd rolls.
What is the probability of rolling an even number?
Robbie, do you have this one for me?
3 out of 6.
3 out of 6 is correct.
Which, if I reduced it, is 1/2.
Yes, ma'am.
And my probability of rolling an odd number is the same thing.
Yes.
And so I ask you this question. Is this any different than the game where we were flipping a coin and I got paid $1 if I made a heads and I lost $1 if I had tails?
Same game, different game.
Same.
It's the same game, okay? Yes, we're throwing a die instead of a coin, but it's the same game, okay?
So you'll recall
we weren't doing very well with that coin. Let's see if we do any better with the die. It should be about the same. Part A says, suppose you get 45 even numbers in your first 100 rolls. How much money have you won or lost? So 45 evens
would mean that I have a plus $45.
Okay, but unfortunately, since I've thrown it 100 times, I had 55
odds, which resulted in a negative
$55.
And so my net for the night so far would be I've lost $10
on playing this game. All right, part B. Says on the second 100 rolls, my luck improves. Now I roll 47 even numbers. How much money have I won or lost over the 200? So, here we go.
Another 100 rolls. Out of this 100 rolls, I had 47 evens. So I made a plus 47.
But that left me with
53 odd rolls. And so a loss of
$53. And so my net here is how much? Anybody got it for me?
Negative 16.
Is it 16 or is it just 6?
Well, total.
Oh, you're saying
total. Okay. Just in this 100 rolls, it's a negative 6, right?
And then they asked me for the total for the night. So my total
for the night or for the game
is now I've lost $16.
Okay. And I've thrown die 200 times.
Okay.
This thing continues. Part C. Your luck continues to improve, and you roll 148 even numbers in your next 300 rolls. I personally feel that we need to find something new to do with our time. But, okay.
I have to save some board space. There we go.
So after 200 rolls,
we're at minus 16. We'll make that a lot smaller.
And then we do part C. Okay, so again, let's read that. What's happening? We're getting luckier and luckier, okay? Luck continues to improve and you roll 148 even numbers out of your next 300 rolls, okay? So I'm going to toss 300 tosses.
300 rolls. And I get 148 evens.
And so I'm at plus $148.
Minus $152. So now my net,
oh wait, 300 rolls. Yeah, that's right. Okay. And so now the difference between the two is only a negative 4. Okay. Now, I would also point out here that
every time I've had fewer evens than odds,
is it very likely that every single time I'm going to have fewer evens than odds? And they're getting closer to 50-50. You'd think one of those times you'd have more odds than, or more evens than odds, but so far, no. Okay.
So then my total after
500 rolls.
Okay.
I've lost 16 down here. I've lost another 4. So now I've lost $20.
Okay.
And I've thrown the dice or the die 500 times.
Part D, how many even numbers would you have to roll in the next 100 rolls so that you would break even? Hey, forget winning.
Can I just go home with the same amount of money that I started with? Well, that means I need to win $20, true? How many even numbers do I have to get on my next 100 rolls?
70.
I need 70 evens. Let's try it out. Which would leave me with 30 odds. Okay, so that I was Plus 70 here.
Minus 30 here.
That would give me a net of plus 40. Oh, I'd do better than break even on that. Wouldn't I, Steve? I'd actually go home with $20 in my pocket. So I think we can back down our number. 70 is more than I would have to have. Anybody disagree?
Are we okay with that?
So let's rethink. What would I have to have just so I broke even? I need to make $20, right? So I need 20 more evens than odds. So I need two numbers that add up to make 100 and are different by 20.
60-40?
Will that get it done for me? If I throw 60 even numbers, I'm going to have plus $60. If I throw 40 odds, I'm going to have minus $40.
Which means my net
is a plus 20.
And up here, I had a
minus 20, and I broke even for the evening. How likely is it that 60% of my rolls are going to be even? Is that likely to happen?
Not in the single event, but if he keeps on playing, eventually it will even out.
In a single event, it's not likely. So in 100 rolls, it's not likely. Okay. The problem is once you get behind, it's very hard to catch up. Okay. But we are, if we keep rolling and keep rolling, okay, we are going to get closer and closer to reaching that 50-50 mark. Okay. It is going to get closer to that. But the likelihood in just 100 tosses of getting 60 even numbers is not very likely at all. We look back at all the tossing we've already done, and we never hit 60 of either one, okay? Even in, there was 100 rolls, and it wasn't there yet, okay? So it's not very likely, but we do see that our total is getting closer and closer to 50-50, all right? My problem is I need to get ahead in order to break even, and I'm not very likely to get ahead. We will get closer and closer, however, to 50-50. So if I stay in the game long enough, yeah, probably I can break even. I don't know. I got other things to do with my time. I'm sure of that. Okay, let's look at, that's the only thing I had for part C.
Let's go to part D. And I want to look at, it's on page,
I know where I am, 34.
Yeah, the aging American population table. Yes, that is on page 455.
And that table on aging is at the top of that page. Question 34.
I want us to try to do a problem where we have
a whole table of values to make sure that we understand how to handle our table and get the calculations that they're asking us for.
Okay. So in part, let's see, this is the table shows the U.S. population and the number of Americans that are over age 65 at 10-year intervals. Okay, the number of people that are over 65 in 10-year intervals since 1940, which is about when the Social Security program was created. So this is going to connect back, all right? This is going to connect back to our conversation about Social Security. I talked to you about the fact that we've been going through a period of history where the baby boomer generation was employed. We were all at work,
okay? But now baby boomers are retiring, okay?
I represent the tail end of that generation. I'm not planning on retiring next year or anything, but retirement is looking closer than it ever used to before, okay? So as more and more baby boomers are retiring, then the population of Americans that are over age 65 gets larger and larger. And that's what you see going on in this table, okay? So the top line is the total U.S. population, and then the second line is the number of Americans that are over 65, and each of these are stated in millions of people. So in 1940, our population was 132 million people, and of those 132 million people, only 9 million of them were over age 65. Think back to that life expectancy thing, okay? People weren't living to 65 in 1940, so much. So here we go. This is what we're looking at. Make a table showing the percent of the U.S. population over age 65 between 1940 and 2010. So I wish I had a slide that just had these numbers on it, but I don't, all right? So I want you to imagine, I'm not going to recreate the whole table. It would just take more time than it's worth. Here's 1940, 1950, 60. Does it go to 2000?
No one's going to tell me. They can be walking.
It goes to 2010.
It goes to 2010. All right. It's a good thing I had a little bit more white space left. There we go. So for every one of those years, I want to calculate the percentage of people who are over age 65. Okay? So I need
the number of people over age 65 divided by the total number of people. This is part divided by whole. That's our calculation every time.
And then times 100 in order to actually make it a percentage. So in my first column in 1940, I got 9 out of 132,
which is 0.068 or 6.8%.
And then when we move to 1950, we've got 12.
0.7
over 151. Both numbers are rising, okay? Population is rising. People over the age of 65 also rising. And this one is
8.4%,
okay? We continue calculating. In 1960, it's 17.2 over 179. And so my percentage is 9.6,
okay?
This is not a very big percentage of people over the age of 65. Now, certainly a good chunk of the rest of the population is under 18 or under 20. They're not bringing in any money. But most of the rest of them are working, and so it is easy for the people who are in the employment force to support this number of retired people. The dollars going into Social Security are much higher than the dollars that need to be paid out. So let's jump down here and go to about 1990. Now we have 31.9 million people that are over the age of 65, and we have 249 million people total in our population. This is 12.8%. Almost double what it was in 1940. In the year 2000,
we've got 34.9
over 281. This brings us to 12.4. It actually goes down a little bit. And then in 2010, you've got 40.4 over 309. And you're up to 13.07%, okay, or 13.1. So we see that the percentage of people over 65 is increasing across time, all right, representing baby boomers starting to reach retirement age. Then they ask us to calculate what is the percentage increase in the U.S. population between 1940 and 2010. Okay, so in 1940, there were 132 million
people.
Okay, and in 2010, there were 309 million people. I chose this question because it goes back and it reviews a lot of things that we did earlier in class. We're trying to get ready for that cumulative test in a week. All right. So we want to revisit some of these ideas. It says find the percent increase. Okay. So you might have to flip back. I think it's in chapter 3. Okay. You're going to find a formula for percent increase. I'll give you a minute to do some page turning. See if you can find your formula for percent increase. Be glad that you don't have to flip through the whole book on test day. You'll just have those formula sheets on your screen or printed out if you prefer them in that form. It's the difference of the top two numbers.
309
subtract 132 in millions, okay? Divided by
the reference number, which you
remember is the first number, okay? We said our reference point is always where things started, or the earlier value. And that's going to give us
a 1.34,
okay,
or 134%, okay?
So population has more than doubled, and sure enough it has, okay? Double population would have been 264, we're at 309. So, yeah, we should expect this number greater than 100, although somehow we almost never really expect a number greater than 100. Okay, there's that change. So that's part B, change in total population.
What is the percent
increase in the over 65 population during that same time frame? So we've looked at the percentage increase in the general population, and now we want to look at the percentage increase of the over 65 crowd. So now I need to compare in 1940,
there were 9 million. I was better off with my zeros.
Okay, and then over here in 2010, there were
40.4 million.
And I want to, again, do this same calculation, percent change, all right? What's the percentage change? And so I'm going to have
new
subtract reference
divided by
reference. And see what that calculation is. Now I get 3.49
or 349%.
And now you begin to see why people are a little bit nervous about Social Security.
Part D. In 2010, there were approximately
165 million Americans of working age.
Estimate, with reasons,
the number of people who were actually working and contributing to Social Security in 2010, and compare this to the number over 65.
Okay,
I'm not going to go even through a calculation because they're asking us to estimate numbers that we're probably not that qualified to estimate. So I'm not going to worry about that so much. But I want us to look at
question
E and try to think about some reasoning.
What's the result
of this effect on future programs such as Social Security and Medicare? Well, if the people drawing Social Security and Medicare are increasing at a much greater rate than the general population, that's a cause for concern in terms of the solvency of the program. It worked very well in these early years, but now we're looking at numbers that don't look as good. And the total numbers don't look so bad, but when you look at the relative growth between the two categories, it makes you a lot more nervous. about how this thing's going to remain solid. Okay? So, again, why did I choose this problem? I want to review all these different calculations that we've done.
Because
when I'm asking you questions, when I wrote your test, I didn't write it in the order of the book. Okay? It's going to skip around with different ideas. And there are things in this book, and you can see we're doing a question
in chapter 7
in which we are using formulas from chapter 3. Okay? Because all of these ideas are tied together. That's the beauty of math. Math models the world. And so the better I understand my mathematical model, the better I understand ideas that are being discussed in the news.
Okay?
We talked about the total U.S. budget and how such a big percentage of it are entitlement programs like this. We don't cut those because we believe these people are entitled to what they were promised. But then it doesn't leave us a very big piece of the pie to discuss how we're going to divide that for other things. And so how do we handle that? So, you know, usually if you look at your budget and you say, wow, we just don't have enough money to go around, we say, well, we've got to increase our income. So somebody goes and takes a part-time job, or somebody looks for a better job, or something like that. Well, how does the U.S. government increase their income? They have to increase their income by raising our taxes.
People tend to scream about that. But
there's reasons why it might not be an unreasonable thing to do, all right, when we examine things like this. So just being aware of what the numbers actually say, being able to be a citizen that understands those numbers, I think that's really important for us. And that's part of why, you know, I've selected the text I have and the calculations that we do. It's just to try to be aware of ideas that are being discussed. All right, we do not do 7E. You are not responsible for that at all. So these four sections that we've covered in Chapter 7, the first four sections, that is all that you're going to be quizzed over or tested over, all right? I mentioned in office hours, and I will mention again, this week, you're doing your practice quiz, all right? You're submitting more items for your portfolio because your portfolio is due. Complete the requirements for the portfolio. At the end of this week, you should have all 10 submissions in there, all right? I will try to look very diligently over the weekend and grade any items you already have in there so that you can get an idea, and I'll give you some feedback so that if I don't think you're really on target, I'll give you some feedback so you can do better on the rest of them, all right? But if you don't have anything in there, I can't give you any feedback. So I will be looking. I will check over the weekend to see how it looks. It's not all due until the end of the week, okay? But it is due at the end of this week. After that, I have to start taking late deductions. So please turn it in for full credit. I really strongly encourage you to do that. There's yet another stewardship journal entry to be done, all right? And when we reach week 6, next week at this time, when we're getting together, I will be here at 6 for office hours, and I will simply start reviewing. If you send me questions, message them to me, okay? If you send me messages, I want you to do a problem of this type. You can, like, take a problem off of a practice quiz or whatever and say, would you please do this problem? I need help with this kind. I will just put all those together, and I'll start in, and I'll start reviewing. And then as people come into the discussion in the chat, just take questions from the audience. It is just a full-scale review that you're going to drive, okay? I mean, I'll have some things in my back pocket to do if everybody just sits there like, my life is wonderful, I have no questions to ask. But I would rather answer your questions than just, you know, try to read your mind and guess what your questions are. I'm not very good at that, okay? So you know, as participants in the class, whether you're watching the recording and you're responding to me to that, or whether you're actually in class, you're going to drive that review. And we will review from 6 o'clock until about 7:15 or 7:30. 7:30 at the latest, we're going to cut it off, take a 15-minute break, and then start our test. Okay? And the test finishes the class. So no new material is going to be discussed next week. We're just going to be reviewing the things that we've had.
Remember the things we did in the
first week
and about half of the
second week material. That was on that Unit 1 test. It's not going to be on this test. We're talking about chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
And we did not do
all of this. Go back and look at how much we covered. That's what we're testing over. You will find in, when we get to week 6, let me find it here. There's a practice quiz for your summative test, okay? That's just to help you get ready. So you can take it over and over as many times as you want. And it's pulling questions from every different source that we did, okay? Trying to give you a mix of the kind of questions that will be on that last summative test. So this week, you finish up your portfolio and you work just on the Chapter 7 material.
Probability,
okay? And then next week, during week 6, you're practicing everything all together. And I would, you know, if I was you, I would print out, if you like a hard copy, print out all those formula sheets. Or you can just, you know, flip the pages in the back of your book, whatever you need to do. But here's the formula sheets. So can you see the formula sheets here? Okay, so you can print those out if you want to print them out yourself. Okay? And have your own printout copies that you're practicing with all week during the last week.
And that was my question.
What was your question?
Well, you just answered it.
Oh, can you print them? Yes, feel free to print them. If you go home and you find out you can't see it, you can see it on my screen, but you can't see it on yours, then shoot me a quick note. It just means I need to say, to make it visible. It may be hidden from you and only visible to me. Because I noticed this looks gray where it says resources and this looks black, okay?
Right.
So there's a chance that this is hidden from you right now. It's easy for me to change that. So I don't even have to ask Kyle to do that. I knew that. I know how to do that one by myself. So if you send me a note, I'll make it visible. If I remember, I'll go home and just check and make sure that it's visible to you. Because it could just be gray print, but it could be hidden. And I don't know which it is without checking. Anything else you would like to know?
Could you briefly go over the In Your World portfolio? I'm not real clear on the instructions for that.
Absolutely. Let's go look there. Good items for In Your World portfolio. Okay, so open a new one. Here is your step-by-step right here for each one, and you're going to do 10 of them. Okay? Now, those 10 come from these listings right here. Okay, they come from down here. You can see there's a lot more than 10. I don't care which ones you do. I want you to pick ones that you're interested in or that you think favor your skill set, okay? Some of these require calculations and some of them don't require any kind of calculation at all. So if you don't love calculations, you're going to pick that other kind, all right? And if you kind of like math, then pick a calculation one. So let's just grab one for the sake of discussion that came from what we talked about tonight. So I'm going to look at, in Section 7C, because my book is almost there, Section 7C, question number 42, is on page 446.
Okay.
It's under this category called In Your World. I think almost 100% of these are under the category In Your World, okay, at the end of each section of the book that we have covered. So question 42 says this. Republican Senator Richard Lugar attacked state-supported lotteries and the trend toward increasing legalization of gambling, saying the spread of gambling is a measure of the moral erosion taking place in our country. It says that if you play enough, you can hit the jackpot and be freed from the discipline of self-support through a job or the long commitment to ongoing education. Do a web search on gambling and morality to find other opinions on this issue. Write a short summary of your findings and your own opinion, which you should defend clearly. Now, how long is this supposed to be? It's not a research paper, okay? Go back up here and look, and I'm describing, all right, that this should be, let's read, I gotta get this out of my way so I can read. Fight over, okay. All 10 responses should be submitted at the same in the same assignment space. However, this assignment allows students to make submissions more than once, so you don't have to do all 10 at the same time. All right? I'm looking for you to make a sound, logical, and quantitative reasoning on a current reference. Okay? Each new selection is in a new document style. Here it is. Open a Word document, copy and paste the article or articles you used, or just citations for them is fine, but MLA citations, okay? So that if you use a link, I can click on that and I can go look and see what you were looking at, all right? If it's not reasonable to copy and paste, put in a link. Then write your response below the article. Each response should be no more than a half a page. Does everyone see this? Okay, no more than a half a page. Some of them are gonna be shorter than that because there's just not that much to say. This one here probably has more writing than most of them because you're gonna try to find two or three people's opinion, not just Mr. Luger's, and you're gonna state your own. So you're gonna cite a reference for the other opinions you found, then you're gonna state your own opinion, and you're going to state clearly why you believe what you believe about this issue. So if you choose this one, this is what you're going to do. You're not calculating anything, okay? You're looking at the morality of gambling and what do you believe about it. So it's, you know, it's math in our world today, but it's not you doing that. Does this make sense? You're going to do 10 of these.
So my actual writing is only going to be about a half a page for each one of these items, and I'm only doing 10 of them.
You've got it. And the top half of the page is going to be where you copy and paste as part of your article, your entire article, you know, or at least like one sentence. Is that the key thing you're going to reference out of that article, along with a proper MLA citation of that article or web page?
And each one has to be in its own Word document. I can't have them all together.
No, I put each one in a separate Word document. It's much better for me grading, and it's set for you to drop them in one at a time. Please also notice my directions for naming the document. I beg, I plead, okay? If you will save each document and name it this way, your name comes first, underscore the chapter, underscore the section. So for this one that we just looked at, it would be 7C, number 42, okay, or 7C, maybe that's all it has to be. Your name underscore 7C, and then the question number. That way, each time I look at your document, I know which question it's going to be about. I don't have to open it up and then try to guess, all right? So put which one it is in the name of the document. It just saves me. You can't imagine how much time if you will do that. So that's why I've got it up here in the directions. Please name the files this way. When we did our discussion board, week two, every person was supposed to pick one of these and do it, and that's what they put on the discussion board. And then you discussed with other people how effectively you thought they discussed theirs, and I got into some discussion and whatever. And that was your chance to kind of practice one with feedback. Feedback from me, feedback from your peers, and then I said, fix it up, make it the best it can be, and that's your first submission here. So if you go back to the discussion board, you've got one you already did if you participated in the discussion board that week. Now, not everybody did, but I think most people I'm talking to right now did. All right, so go back and look at that. That was your first submission. You've just got to go ahead and make sure you get it in a Word document and submit it in your portfolio. Does that help you, Steve?
Yes, a lot. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. I don't want this to be burdensome. I really would like it to be rather fun. You're picking out the things that are of interest to you. Somewhere in here, there's one that talks about constructing a pie chart and something else. And I don't remember which one it is, but it's somewhere in chapter four because that's where we talked about building different kinds of things. Here, it's this one, 5C, 54 and 55. You do them both. It's the same set of data, and one of them you build a bar graph, and the other one you build a pie chart. And if you are good at using Excel, that is super easy to do. You don't have to write me a word about it. You just have to have an accurate pie graph and bar graph for the data that you are given, okay? On the other hand, if you hate Excel, I wouldn't choose that one, okay? Just pick something else and let that one go. You're selecting for you from within your skill set and your interests. Anything else we should talk about tonight to help us finish strong?
I was just looking at my Patreon. I can't see those formula sheets you said you would put out. They're not visible to me.
They are not visible to you. I will try to fix that before I close out this webpage tonight, all right? So that they are visible to you. No reason for them not to be. Anything else that I need to know or you need to know?
No, thank you.
All right, wonderful. Have a good week, all right? And I will see you for our finale in 1 week from tonight. Good night, everybody.
Good night.